Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Pamela Schuler, a remarkable woman, Jewish inclusion advocate, and stand-up comedian. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim Bar El Kahar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It was Yom Yerushalayim last week, the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem, which means that it's now been half a century since the Six-Day War. Over the past few weeks here on Two Jewish, we've been exploring the impact of those five decades on the various areas that fell under Israeli control after the incredible military victory over the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. We began 2 weeks ago discussing East Jerusalem, the old city itself, moved on to explore the results, opportunities, and challenges posed by the Israeli capture of the Sinai, the Golan Heights, and Gaza last week, and today and next week we'll look at the most problematic area today, the West Bank of the Jordan, and the territories Israel captured from Jordan almost against its will in 1967. Before we explore the complex area of the West Bank, a word about another region that became part of Israel after the Six-Day War. Jericho and the area around the middle and north shore of the Dead Sea also fell into Israeli hands after the Jordanian army withdrew following its defeat by the IDF in Jerusalem and the West Bank. Jericho was eventually given to the Palestinian Authority to control as part of the Oslo process of the 1990s, and it hasn't been the site of much controversy in a long time. The West Bank, of course, is another story altogether. The name, the West Bank, has become a kind of politically charged mantra all around the world, so it's useful to unpack it. The Jordan River is one of the few full rivers that flow through the Promised Land, and it's an unusual one. It runs from the north of Israel into the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret, which it fills, and then flows back out to the south along the very deep Jordan Rift Valley until it terminates in the Dead Sea, lowest place on the face of the earth. In general, the upper Jordan River above the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, flows through the Hula Valley, and no one talks about east and west banks of the Jordan in that part of the river. The section of the river after it leaves the Sea of Galilee and meanders south is the part that has all the fancy political names and provokes all the name-calling. In biblical times, the West Bank of the Jordan was part of the Kingdom of Israel, which also usually included the East Bank of the Jordan, the land that makes up the best part of the modern nation of Jordan. That is, biblical Israel was mostly located on the central mountainous and hilly spine of the country. It covered both banks of the Jordan. Generally speaking, the Jewish nation of the Bible did not have a lot of land on the Mediterranean coast and was more east in location than the modern nation of Israel. In fact, two of the 12 tribes of Israel had lands located on the east bank of the Jordan. They only crossed the Jordan to help the rest of the Israelites conquer their own lands, and then they moved back. I am always bemused by those who wish Israel had the same borders it used to possess in biblical times, because God promised us the land, and we should have the same land, all the same land promised 3,000 years ago. Well, if that indeed were to become true, contemporary Israel would gain the mostly barren hills of the West Bank, ancient Judea and Samaria, and even some of the East Bank of the Jordan River, today's brown hills in the nation of Jordan. On the downside, Israel would have to give up most of its densely populated coastal cities like Tel Aviv, Caesarea, the high-tech center of Herzliya, as well as its main ports at Haifa and Ashdod, the majority of its industry and infrastructure, and of course, all that lovely Mediterranean coastline and its beaches. They are located on lands that in Bible times belonged to the Philistines, the Phoenicians, and the Canaanites, not the ancient Israelites. This is not a trade I think any sane Israeli is going to make. But in antiquity, the area of today's West Bank was very much part of the Israelite heartland. The very first real estate ever purchased by a Hebrew in what later became the land of Israel was in Hebron, biblical Hebron, when Abraham bought the cave of Machpelah. King David's first capital city before the capture of Jerusalem from the Jebusites was Hebron, and Jews settled in these populated areas of the land as much as anywhere else in the first decades of the growth of the Yishuv, the Jewish pre-national entity in Israel in the 1800s and 1900s. Of note, the Jordan River was not really a boundary of much of anything in biblical times or in modernity until the British began to consider it a logical place to divide the land that they had promised to both the Jews and the Arabs. Various English governments did this in the early 1900s. The final UN partition plan gave parts of the West Bank to the Jews and parts to the Arabs in a crazy quilt of unconnected territories in 1947. At the end of the War of Independence, the Milchemet HaShichrur, and the 1949 ceasefire, Israel had held on to very little of the area of the West Bank, including the much-fought-over fortress of Latrun that was in Jordanian hands, and the green line boundary that was drawn on maps, which became the basis for the original borders of Israel, was a strange, bulbous arrangement. It left Israel perilously thin in the middle of the country, and left some strong Jewish kibbutzim and areas of Jewish population concentration in the hands of the Jordanians. It wasn't so much a solution or a permanent border as just the place where things stopped, and it certainly wasn't intended to be a workable final arrangement. The north of Israel was separated from the central and southern parts of Israel by this weird configuration of the West Bank, with only a thin strip of land connecting the two halves of the nascent nation, very vulnerably so. Israel functioned around these strange boundaries for the first 19 years of its existence and worked on building up the country. The Jordanians, by contrast, invested very little in the West Bank when it was under their auspices, for a variety of reasons, mostly because it was occupied by Arabs of a different origin than the ruling clan of the Hashemites. Most of the refugees from the War of Independence were stuck in camps for the entirety of Jordanian rule, that is, the Arab refugees, and they provided them with very few services and no hope. In essence, the population base for future terrorism was built by the Jordanian army, at least in the West Bank. In 1967, Israel had exactly no military plan in place to capture or even invade the West Bank. Israeli leaders tried diligently to persuade King Hussein to stay out of the war, even desperately so. But on the first day of the war, Nasser persuaded Hussein to attack Israel, likely on the basis of false intelligence, pretending to show Egyptian planes had attacked Israel when actually almost all the Egyptian planes were destroyed. Israel stayed on the defensive for a while against Jordanian attacks until the Jordanian army began shelling Jerusalem, targeted the prime minister's residence and most of downtown, and the Jordanian air force attacked as far as Netanya. Within 2 days of hard fighting, the Israeli army completely defeated the Jordanians, drove them not only from Jerusalem, but from the whole of the West Bank, unexpectedly. Uzi Narkis, the general of the Central Command for Israel in the war, said, "First, the Israeli government had no intention of capturing the West Bank. On the contrary, it was opposed to it. Second, there was not any provocation on the part of the IDF. Third, the rein was only loosened when a real threat to Jerusalem's security emerged. This is truly how things happened, June 5th, 1967, although it is difficult to believe. The end result was something no one had planned." You can make a strong case that this accidental occupation of so much territory located in the heart of ancient Israel provided a very strange opportunity. But the land was far from unoccupied. Next week, we'll probe the complex issues created and the long-term struggles to provide some sort of reasonable framework for living in the West Bank. To play us in this morning, here's a lovely, sad song of the Six-Day War sung by Nachama Hendel. I got your letter.
Sigenon ha-michtavim shone mikod oduach en tzorech ledayek efshar gam le'aleter ha-layla ha-yored
יפה הוא כידוע, אבל שחור שערך יפה יותר. הלילה היורד יפה הוא כידוע, אבל שחור שערך יפה יותר. דומה שרק אתמול וכבר חלף שבוע, וכבר אכלנו כאן אבק דיה והותר. הרוח הקיצית חמה היא כידוע, אבל מגע ידך חמים יותר. הרוח הקיצית חמה היא כידוע, אבל מגע ידך חמים יותר. החקי קצת גדול ולא מועיל שכנוע, כי עם אפסנאים לא קל להסתדר. הנשק האישי מכביד הוא כידוע, אך המרחק ממך מכביד יותר. הנשק האישי.
That was Nachama Hendel from the era of the Six-Day War, now 50 years ago this week. Our guest this morning is inclusion advocate Pamela Schuler, a severe victim of what is often a debilitating disease, who's overcome adversity to become a great advocate for Jewish inclusion, and a very entertaining and successful stand-up comedian. Meet her when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Pamela Schuler is an inclusion advocate and stand-up comedian and a remarkable person and speaker. She was diagnosed with one of the worst cases, maybe the worst case of Tourette syndrome ever documented, and yet has risen from that to become a remarkable spokesperson for including people in the Jewish community. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tell us how you started in all of this.
With comedy or speaking or all of it?
You just started, so keep going.
So I've been doing comedy for a long time. My boarding school thought it might be an outlet that worked for me, and they were absolutely correct. They were able to kind of channel my snarkiness and my inappropriateness into something a bit more productive. And then for years, I was also speaking on the side about having Tourette's and what does it mean to really love being different. And then a few years ago, I had this aha moment, and I was like, these things don't have to be separate. So I started speaking and using comedy in the same things, and I call it stand-up inclusion. And it's really both comedy and messages about loving our differences and what does it really mean to overcome obstacles in a way that they don't go away, but you embrace them.
You know, when you spoke at my synagogue here at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona, the first thing we had to do was get you a higher box to stand on. So people on radio can't see that you are, for all of your extraordinarily large personality, not very tall.
No, I'm 4'7". Give or take an eighth of an inch at any given time.
Listen.
My doctor a few months ago said 4'6", and I was like, well, let's try that again.
How did that impact your ability to look at the world from down below and, forgive me for saying that, and see how important it was to include?
I mean, I love being short. I love being short, and I love having Tourette's. These are all things I'm very open about, but I think instead of getting angry about being 4'7" and barking without provocation, you know, from Tourette's and things like that, I kind of learned that it gives me this unique point of view. And in comedy, that's been incredibly helpful. And so I wouldn't give it up. I love being short, but it's also, it shows me the world from a different point of view. And I think that helps me in all of my work, everything that I do.
As a, you know, you've talked in the past, heard you talk about how being a stand-up comedian, you know, you just sort of hit on that as the, it just was you. Because how did they come to suggest that?
So I was a tough, snarky high schooler. And by the time I got to the sporting school, I was depressed and I struggled and I'd broken bones from Tourette's and had years of really the messaging being that like different was bad, and that I was just my disability. And so boarding school, I started pushing the world away from me as equally as I felt like the world had pushed me away. And I was snarky and tough and I lived in detention. And so my boarding school was having me do things like write apology notes to people or walls that I had wronged. And they were looking at these notes and like, they're funny. They're hilarious. I have them still. And none of them are real apologies. They're all things like, I'm sorry, you're an idiot. And you know, I did some incredibly smart, albeit wrong, things, but they were smart and funny. And so I think they started to catch on that, like, if they can channel this energy, it would be amazing. So they tried a few different things in stand-up and improv. It just connected at such an incredible level because you can be any, you know, when you do stand-up or improv, you get on stage to be yourself. And it would be okay if I was flailing or barking or making noises. That adds to it. It doesn't take anything away.
We will talk much more with Pamela Schuler, not only about her comedy, but about her work for inclusion within the Jewish community when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. This coming week, we celebrate the major but often forgotten Jewish holiday of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. Shavuot, or Shavuos, celebrates the receiving of the Ten Commandments at Sinai. It concludes a process of counting the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuot, the counting of the Omer. Shavuot is also called Chag HaBikurim, the holiday of the first fruits, falling as it does in late spring, when the very first crops begin to ripen in hot climates like Israel or Tucson, Arizona, where I live. It's a shame so many Jews ignore Shavuot. In truth, this festival, which begins Tuesday night, continues Wednesday, is an important holiday. Thursday, too, if you're conservative or Orthodox, by the way. It was on Shavuot that, according to Jewish tradition, the greatest human interaction with God in all history took place. At this time of year, 3,200 years ago or so, we received the Ten Commandments in dramatic fashion. In the book of Exodus, the commandments were given with lightning and thunder, smoke and fire and an earthquake and the blast of the shofar ringing out in the clear desert air. Out of all that tumult, God's voice conveyed the great message of morality and ethics that includes the Ten Commandments. Without Shavuot, we don't have the Torah, and without the Torah, we don't have Judaism. And of course, if we don't have Judaism, we would never have had Christianity or Islam or Western civilization. So Shavuot or Shavuos matters very much. Here's a musical introduction on the subject of Mount Sinai from the great ensemble, the Boston Camerata, a song to Moses, Mi al Har Chorev, literally, who on Mount Sinai spoke to God face to face. Me, Al Har Chorev, for the holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos, this coming Tuesday night and Wednesday. We'll have our Tikkun Leil Shavuot, our service and study session for the evening of Shavuot, with our cheesecake bake-off at my own synagogue, Temple Emmanuel, beginning at 8 p.m. Tuesday night. Don't miss it. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked last week about the kind of aftermath of the French elections and Macron and how it was sort of a uniquely French phenomenon, even though it's seen as part of a larger trend, which you make a good point. It's really maybe not that. Let's talk about Britain a little bit and Brexit and the progress there or direction of what has led England to pull out of the EU and how all that's playing out.
Well, in the French case, I think it was a question of, you know, two different visions of what it means to defend French identity. And so that means two different global definitions of what French identity is, French culture, French values, et cetera, et cetera. In England, there's not too much disagreement on what British identity is and British values, stiff upper lip, and being different from the rest of Europe. Brits have never considered themselves Europeans. It's a historic accident that they ever joined the European Union. They certainly never gave up the pound sterling, which has a long, solid tradition. They would never give up the Bank of England and be subject to the European Central Bank, God forbid. Those things were always anathema to Brits. So it was really only a question, it was never a question of will they leave the Union. It was a question of when will they leave the Union and what events might precipitate that.
Are you sure that's not just, you know, hindsight is always 20/20?
No, I always said this.
Okay.
And I say it for several reasons. First of all, the Brits have a long tradition of seeing themselves as other than Europe and also other than America, somewhere between.
Right.
Not only geographically. I mean, geographically, they would situate themselves somewhere southwest of Iceland in the middle of the Atlantic if they could. But there was this famous headline once when there were bad storms in the English Channel saying the continent is cut off from England. You know, not we're cut off from the continent, right? Because the world revolved around them. And there was a time when the sun never set on the British Empire.
Of course.
And the pound sterling and British usage and British manners and British theater and British humor were the stock and trade of the world. And that period lasted much longer than the period in which French was the international language and French manners and culture and theater were the stock and trade of the world. I mean, however much the French might argue against that, only the French felt a need to create a ministry of la francophonie, the French speaking. The Brits never felt a need because English was a naturally dominant language that was spoken by, you know, more than a billion Indians and lots of other people around the world and whatever. So the British vote, I don't think, has to do with xenophobia or economics or anything so much as we were never comfortable being part of Europe. And it's like, when are we going to get out? And lots of Europeans are chafing under the rules and regulations of unelected officials who comprise the European Commission in Brussels, who decide what size a tomato has to be and how long a cucumber has to be and whatever. And the Brits don't like overregulation. The Brits, remember, were always anti-papist. They don't like over-centralization, and they certainly don't like foreign control. They've never been successfully conquered since William the Conqueror in 1066.
Yeah,
right.
A few years ago.
So they didn't want to be conquered by Brussels either, and it was just a question of when.
Well, it's very interesting, and it's funny how we tend to think we understand what's going on when we often don't even have the first step into the arena of understanding what's going on. We'll talk next week maybe and look also at how America fits into all of this. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Bar El-Kahar, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Bar.
Boker Or.
So it's Memorial Day weekend, and Memorial Day is kind of a big deal still in America, but Israel has its own Memorial Day, Yom HaZikaron, which was right before Yom HaTzmaut, the Israeli Day of Independence. Tell us your thoughts about Israel's Memorial Day as we commemorate this American Memorial Day.
Yeah, so I think it is very different from the American Memorial Day, because then I know in America you have a big barbecue and you talk about a lot about the soldiers, and basically you just go on sales. I know you go a lot on sales.
Yeah, you go buy
America.
Stuff because
yeah.
everything's on sale for Memorial Day.
Exactly. In but. Israel, I don't think you would sell anything because in Israel, it's a really meaningful holiday for people. So in my school, for say, I was a big part of always saying a passage for Memorial Day or talking about it in Israel, Yom HaZikaron, because it has a lot to do with the soldiers. It's just to commemorate the soldiers that died in the wars. And in Israel, everybody in someone's family was part of a war and had a casualty. And it's really something that touches everybody because it's not like this thing out there that my friend's daughter, friend, I don't know, had a guy a soldier. It's everybody has a specific connection with someone and you feel it when it comes to time to memorize them in Memorial Day in Israel, Yom HaZikaron. Everybody feels it.
You know, it's partly two things. One is universal military service. All the guys go in. Most of the women go in. And it's kind of the central institution in Israeli society. But the other part is the wars don't just affect a small portion of the population, as you said. Israel's a small country. You know, the active army is not really that huge. Lots of people have been actively involved. When you do Memorial Day, there's that siren. Talk about that a little bit, would you?
That's something extremely powerful and a big part of it. Because on Memorial Day in Israel, you have that siren in the morning. I think 10 a.m. in the morning.
How did they decide what time on Yom HaZikaron to play
I'm
the
not
siren?
Really sure, but I'd rather think that it's the time that would benefit all the people and everybody would stand up for it. I'm not sure, but I think that when people hear the siren, it's just a universal thing in Israel that everybody stops what they're doing and they get up for the siren.
Is
and they
2 minutes long? I mean, it's really
two
long.
Minutes, and you stand up and you be quiet for 2 minutes. Maybe you think about specific things
yeah,
in your
I've
head.
I've been in
you,
a car. Everybody stops their car. It doesn't matter if you're on the highway. Pull mm-hmm. off. Well, they don't always pull over. Stop their cars, get out, and just listen to the siren until it finishes. Like everything stops.
It is extremely powerful to feel it and be experience a part of it, and you know that in those 2 minutes you'll come in a realization for they hadn't done the last year, and you know that it's going to affect your life in some specific way, because that is just an amazing day, I think, for everybody to have
a powerful memorial to those who have died to provide the freedom that Israel was able to experience. And you know, it'd be powerful in America if we could recover some of that sense of universal commitment and service, which is so central to Israeli society.
I think so.
Thanks. We'll talk, Par.
Thank you.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov.
Shavua Tov, and we are coming up on a holiday very much related to Shavuot.
Yes.
The Feast of Weeks.
Nice connection there.
I did the best I could. this is an interesting holiday because most Jews have no idea what the heck it is.
Right. The Forgotten Holiday, sometimes it's called.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's a holiday we remember receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai. You'd think that's the most important event, you know?
Right. So, you know, we take a moment, and it's a holy moment where we gather together, we celebrate, we think about, and we study the importance of Torah. Ten Commandments, the Torah. I mean, this is our iconic literature. This is the age-old, the centuries-old heritage that we work so hard to make valuable and relevant today and feed into tomorrow. This is the book that shapes who we are as a people. These are our ancient stories and experiences. And of course, there's the revelation on Mount Sinai. So it's a big deal.
It is a huge deal. And it's even got a good food, cheesecake.
Yes.
Although why a lactose intolerant people makes that the principal food.
Maybe there's a
food.
Connection there. Too many blintzes.
That's it. It's the blintzes and the cheesecake that get you. The notion that Shavuot is important goes back to its origin. It's one of the three pilgrimage festivals. In biblical times, it was more important than Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, very likely. Nowadays, we do this Tikkun Leil Shavuot, the study session, the night of Shavuot, which was begun in Tzfat 500 years ago, ballpark. It's a great opportunity, if you like to study, to do something in depth. And if you don't like to study, then you're not really Jewish.
Well, we're the people of the book, right? So it's in our DNA. But, you know, it can be challenging to make this one relevant. It's a little tough for us at THA because we're out of school. And it's sort of the Memorial Day, if you will, that kicks off summer in a Jewish way. And I really appreciate that you said it's part of the Shlosh Regalim, because it is right on par with two of the holidays that kind of are universally recognized as the most important holidays in our traditions. But Shavuot's right up there too, and it's important we remember that.
Yeah, you know, like Pesach and Sukkot. But the truth is, freedom, which Passover celebrates, wouldn't mean very much if we didn't have covenant and an ethical code, and that central focus on the Ten Commandments. So wherever you are, go to Shul on Shavuot. It's only one day, okay? If you're conservative or Orthodox, 2 days, but still, you don't have to spend a week. You don't have to take the chametz out of your house.
Right.
You don't have to build a sukkah.
It's sort of low pressure, low octane in that way. And if you can't get to shul, you can certainly jump on a computer or look in your library, pull something out, think about, you know, something Jewish, do a little bit of reading, because study something. You know, if we didn't have the Torah, we wouldn't have these other holidays either. So
it's a low threshold holiday. Great way to begin the summer with something meaningful. Thanks, John.
Enjoy that cheesecake.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
When we return on to Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Morris and Sarah, both in their 80s, invite their grandson Benjamin to dinner one evening. Benjamin is continually impressed by the way Morris precedes every request to Sarah with the most endearing terms. Honey, my love, darling, sweetheart, sugar plum, and so on. This couple, his own Bubby and Zadie, have been married over 50 years and clearly are still very much in love. Before dessert, while Sarah's in the kitchen, Benjamin says to Morris, "Grandpa, Zadie, I think it's totally wonderful that after all these years you still call Bubby these loving pet names. It's so sweet." Morris smiles and says, "I have to tell you the truth, Benji," he says. "I forgot her name about 10 years ago." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the Book of Numbers, called Naso, which includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests are commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing had exceptional importance. As the Torah quotes God saying, "With this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, Samu et Shemi al Bnei Yisrael." That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers God's protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, the highest class of priests, those entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use this blessing at every joyous life cycle event, and it remains powerful. The text is, "May God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace." In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of this portion see the first blessing requesting physical safety and health, the second blessing asking for our material needs to be satisfied, and the third seeking spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives become a challenge. With all three, we are assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, these three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives and true gifts from God. May you each be blessed with all of these this week and always. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Jewish inclusion advocate and stand-up comedian Pamela Schuler, will tell us how Tourette's syndrome has actually helped her discover her own remarkable and powerful voice and helped many others. Find out just how that works when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high school, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Donald Trump made Israel the second stop on his very first foreign trip as chief executive after Saudi Arabia. And aside from some surprising choices on timing, it was mostly uneventful and successful. Trump was in Israel for a total of 27 hours, which gave him time to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu privately and visit the holiest sites briefly. Trump became the first sitting president to visit the Kotel, the Western Wall, while in office. He was presented with a book of Psalms, Tehillim, with his name printed on it by the rabbi of the Western Wall, Shmuel Rabinowitz. The inscription read, "This ancient book will safeguard you so you can safeguard the entire world," with appreciation and admiration for being the first United States president to visit the Western Wall. Like many past presidents, including Barack Obama, Trump visited Yad Vashem, the great Holocaust museum in Jerusalem. He only stayed 30 minutes, however, and did not actually tour the museum, which has the most powerful display on the evil of the Shoah in the whole world. But President Trump did take photos laying a wreath at the memorial at Yad Vashem, and he's signed the guest book. Trump also visited with Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and spoke to a group at the Israel Museum. He chose not to address the Knesset, however, in spite of an invitation to do so, perhaps out of concern that he might be heckled. In public statements, Trump urged the Israelis and Palestinians to work towards a deal for peace, although no current plan is in discussion. Perhaps best of all, Trump's tweets during this trip have been blissfully few and uncontroversial. Oh, and after his visit to the Kotel, Trump's Twitter profile was changed from an Oval Office shot to a picture of him at the Western Wall. Many thousands of people gathered in Jerusalem last week to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the city's reunification. Ceremonies and events occurred throughout the day in the Israeli capital, marking the observance of Jerusalem Day, Yom Yerushalayim, last Wednesday. There were memorials for soldiers killed in the Six-Day War of 67, and a state memorial at Har Herzl Cemetery for the thousands of Ethiopians who died on the way to Israel. Many thousands of young people participated in a flag march through Jerusalem, including in the Muslim quarter of the Old City. Other Jerusalem Day events promoted tolerance and peace. They were held throughout the city. The Knesset held a special session marking Yom Yerushalayim, at which Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said the Temple Mount and the Western Wall will forever remain under Israeli sovereignty, Some see the Six-Day War as a disaster for Israel, but I see it as Israel's salvation. How could we keep existing with a narrow waist and daily danger to our citizens? Prime Minister Netanyahu also said he was moved to see President Donald Trump standing in front of the Kotel, the Western Wall, earlier in the week. The president's visit to the site, Netanyahu said, destroyed UNESCO's propaganda and lies, referring to resolutions the UN passed recently, ignoring and denying the proven fact of the deep Jewish ties to the city of Jerusalem and its holy sites. Most beautifully, the three Israeli paratroopers, whose photograph has symbolized the Jewish return to the Kotel, were back there on Jerusalem Day at the exact hour when they liberated the site 50 years ago. The photograph of them, taken from below, is iconic. Dr. Yitzchak Yifat, Tzion Karasenti, and Chaim Oshri joined many thousands of Jews from around the world marking Jerusalem Day. Returning to the Kotel with these people was almost as exciting as my first time, Karasenti, the first paratrooper to reach the Western Wall in 67, said. To see the joy in their eyes, being with the three of us on this momentous occasion made the moment even more special. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our extraordinary guest this morning. She's stand-up comedian and inclusion advocate, Pamela Schuler. She grew up with the most severe case of Tourette syndrome ever diagnosed. We'll talk about that a little bit, and has risen from that to become a wonderful, charming, and engaging person and a terrific speaker. She has a BA in psychology and youth outreach through the arts from Knox College, a master's in child advocacy and policy from Montclair State. That didn't look like it was all going to happen when you were in school, did it?
It did not, no. In fact, there were years, so I was out of school for 2 full years for my Tourette's being so severe and from broken bones and being disruptive.
Maybe you can explain how somebody breaks bones with Tourette's.
Yeah, so I really lost control over my body. So I threw my head back so hard and so many times that I actually broke my own neck. I remember my mom calling the doctor and saying, "This is what's happening. I think there's a broken bone in there." And they said, "You can't break your neck from a movement disorder. You'd have to be like a car accident." And my mom said, can she just get it looked at? And so I went in and they watched me for a few minutes and they were like, we had no idea. And they x-rayed me and sure enough, a bone in my neck had gone into my skull and was shattering from the top down.
Oh,
so a lot of repetitive, jerky, hard movements. You know, I really severely hurt my arm from throwing my arms into walls, or I ruptured my own appendix from how hard I tensed my stomach muscles. So true injuries were happening.
Most people think of Tourette's as somebody using inappropriate language suddenly, or you talk about barking like a dog, but it's more than that, isn't it?
It is, yes. Although, so some people do also yell words. It's an additional part of Tourette's called corporalia, which I also had at my worst. I did yell words, but the media does a good enough job sensationalizing that, so I kind of stay a little bit away from it because I think the more important part is how it affected my life, and less about the funny words that I may or may not have been yelling. I still do yell cuss words. It's just not from Tourette.
I kind of want to ask why you do nowadays.
Why I yell cuss words nowadays?
Yes.
Oh, because it's sometimes just cathartic. Just yell. As much as the barking from Tourette's drives me a little crazy, I bark at night almost every night. Sometimes it's cathartic to just have to, like, make these loud noises. Also, as a comedian, I'm going to be honest that I'm not the cleanest comedian. So sometimes on stage, I use slightly inappropriate language.
Imagine that. Who could think of a comedian doing such a thing?
Right, right.
You know, we in the Jewish community think of ourselves as very inclusive. Everybody's embraced. Everybody's welcome. That's unfortunately not always true.
Right.
How do you address that with people?
So the fact that I'm being brought to communities and JCCs and synagogues and schools says to me that it's on our radar. It's something we're thinking about, and that's amazing. But I think sometimes we get stuck in things like accommodations, and we're not remembering the why. We accommodate so that we can celebrate. We accommodate so that we can see the best parts of people. I also think we sometimes get stuck in this idea of welcoming. Oftentimes, the folks who feel disconnected or on the periphery are a part of our community. We're just not engaging them in a way that works for them. It's such an incredible thing that people think differently and talk differently and walk differently and see differently. And we sometimes get stuck in what it takes to include everyone rather than the why. So when I'm with communities, I work to kind of get us all in the same mindset of the why we want to be so inclusive. And then I start to help communities get more creative, because oftentimes we get stuck on like one thing works for everyone. I was at a community recently, and I really struggle with sitting through services. I'm always going to struggle with that. I got kicked out of temple as a kid, and it is something I struggle with. And I let them know a few times that I'd be leaving. You know, I'm taking breaks. It's nothing you've done. And I got there, and they said, oh, no, it's okay. We have fidget. And I realized that sometimes we get so comfortable in you know, this accommodation that we think this is what works for everyone, as opposed to listening to somebody and getting to know somebody and then partnering with them to set them up for success.
I hear about how diverse the Jewish community is. And I know in my own synagogue, we have a wide range of races, of ages, of engagement, of people with all kinds of different needs and sexual orientation. And yet when I go to a meeting of the leadership, everybody kind of looks the same.
Same as with our government as well, right?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it may be a little more gender diversified than parts of our government, not mentioning, you know, any names. But but we don't really, when we think about engagement, maybe we're not really doing enough.
So there is a saying, nothing for us without us. And that's a great, you know, oftentimes people in these rooms are talking about inclusion, but is anybody who has a disability or really felt like they were on the periphery included in those conversations? The moment I started feeling included in my boarding school really is where it started, and then my summer camp was when I stopped feeling othered. I stopped feeling like communities were meeting to try to figure out how to include me, and started feeling like I was a voice in the conversation.
That you were just part of it, and it was natural to be doing what you do.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite joke?
Ooh, I never answer this, because it changes week to week, and because my theory is, if you're at dinner with someone and someone says, I'm a proctologist, you wouldn't like bend over and say, can you take a look? So it's always a weird situation.
Doctor, it hurts when I do this.
Right. I actually probably would, because it's free healthcare. But, you know, typically jokes never go well when it's, you know, in a small group of friends or when people aren't like ready to hear comedy. And my favorite joke changes weekly.
All right. So what's your favorite joke this week?
Nope. It'll be awkward, I promise.
Yeah.
I will.
It's a family radio show here, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But I do have a lot of like little stories of things people have said or done to me. I talked a little bit about, or I've been starting openly talking about how when I was much younger, my dad died. And I have a rule that I don't do comedy about anything that I'm not really comfortable with talking about, because when you do it, people heckle, they yell things. You have to be really confident to talk about something. And so I spent years not doing any stand-up about my dad dying, and slowly have started to find all of these funny things surrounding it. And recently I did a whole set about my dad dying, and it was incredibly cathartic and amazing. But you know, for years people have said to me, Pam, I'm so sorry you lost your dad. And it's taken everything for me to not respond with, oh, no, I actually didn't lose him. I know exactly where he is. He's quite literally exactly where I last saw him.
We go to visit him regularly.
Right. You know, that's something I've been having fun with now, is like, what are things people have said to me about Tourette's or being different or my dad dying that are actually really funny? And the moment I'm able to see the humor is the moment I'm able to kind of let go of any negative feelings about the moment.
So what have people said to you about your dad dying besides losing him that was funny? It seems like such a difficult area for comedy.
Yeah. So my dad designed Corvettes. And so many times in my life, somebody who like knew my family has said, God must have wanted a Corvette. Oh, and I always want to respond with like, that he could have asked for a Volvo. And there are many, many, many
things. People really say that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I think there's this desire to make somebody feel better. I'm a big open talker of like how amazing I think therapy is. I think everybody should at some point in their life go to therapy. even if nothing feels kind of out of whack in your life. And it's because there is this desire to make somebody feel better. And sometimes it's okay to, like, sit in not being okay. A lot of times people will say to me how amazing it is that I've overcome Tourette's, right? Like, that's the same idea. And I didn't overcome Tourette's. I've learned to embrace Tourette's, and I've learned to love what it's taught me.
Two thoughts. One is, that's like saying you've overcome your Jewishness.
Right.
It's part of you, right?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
By the way, I've also heard therapy described as Jewish golf.
Ooh, I have not heard that, and I like that.
Yeah,
Although that feels a little athletic to me, and I'm really not athletic.
No, if you think golfers are athletes, I mean, you know, come on.
Anything where you get to drive around and they serve you beer, that cannot true. Be sports.
Or a sport, I guess. So in your work, you go lots of places. What kinds of things do you see that are really good for inclusion, particularly in the Jewish community and synagogues? What has impressed you?
So I think an open dialogue. If communities are constantly having this open dialogue, then I think people are more willing to speak up if they're not feeling included, or if there's an accommodation that really isn't in place, or our parents of young kids with disabilities or special needs are more likely to be open and honest with the religious school about what's going on, because there's not going to be a fear of being told no. So I think that's great, if there's an open dialogue. I also think we get stuck in the work it takes to make the community accessible and accommodating. And we get stuck, I mentioned this before, but we're not always remembering the why. We do it so that we can celebrate every single person. And because if someone can't participate and if someone doesn't feel like they're valued and wanted, then they're not going to bring their whole self to the community. And that makes the community less incredible than it could be. So I think that dialogue is so important. And then there's the tachless things, like we mentioned before, but having, you know, people of all different needs and, you know, people of all walks of life in our meetings and in conversations about the synagogue life and on the leadership team. I think those are like three incredibly important things. I also teach the mindset of yes and, which is something I learned in improv, and it's this idea that you accept what's happening as truth and you build off of it.
So how does that work in inclusion?
You know, if I were to walk into a room and people were like, hey, Pam, you can't bark in here. You can't make noises. Can you stop flailing? I'd leave. That's it. It'd be over. But if you accept me as truth, if you accept my, you know, my disability, my Tourette's as truth and build off of it, then you're more likely to say, yes, we want you here. And yes, let's sit down and have a conversation about what we should set up to make sure that you're successful. And let's continue that conversation. So it's more of a mindset of really starting with a yes and building off of it. I think often we're hesitant to say yes, or someone wants to join our community that's really different from what we've experienced. And there's this urge to start with like maybe, or let's see if we can, rather than yes. And then let's partner and talk and, you know, make your family a part of our community.
I want to thank Pamela Schuller for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I feel like we go on a good deal longer. Where can people go to find out about your comedy and about your inclusion work?
Yes. So I have a website called standupinclusion.com. And it's got some fun clips on there, and I'm posting stuff all of the time. And pretty soon I'll start updating with where I'm going to be and when.
We hope to see you again here in the Southwest soon, and it's just been great being with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Eve Posen, co-author of the new book, Pirkei Imahot, The Wisdom of Mothers, The Voices of Women. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website. Our play out this morning comes from the great Israeli songwriter Naomi Shemer, her classic song Machar, popular at the time of the Six-Day War exactly 50 years ago now. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a wonderful holiday of Shavuot on Tuesday night and Wednesday, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace. המשחטות הישנות ידעינו תפוחי זהב כל זה אינו משל ולא חלום זה נכון כעול בצהריים כל זה יבוא מחר אם לא היום ואם לא מחר Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.